Hey, good morning. It's great to be with you. Like Alex said, he didn't lie. My name is Zach Davey. And it's great to be here this Sunday. Man, I love this church, and I was humbled to be asked to speak here. When I was thinking about it, I was like, you know, somebody obviously needs a little break in the preaching when they're digging this deep into the pulpit, so into the bullpen. So here we are, but I love that I get to preach with you guys because I know you'll give me a lot of grace, so I appreciate that. This is the second time that I preached here at City Light Benson, and I will say that each time I've done it, it has grown my appreciation for how much work it takes to consistently and faithfully preach the gospel. It's hard. It's hard. Like, it takes a lot of time to do it, a lot of digging in. And so I just got to give it up for Alex and Tyler for the work that they do every week, week in and week out. On top of everything else. So, yeah, huge, huge props to those guys. This morning we get to continue on with the Remarkable Women series. And we've been going through that over these last few weeks. It's just been an opportunity for us to highlight women in Scripture that have just been used by God in amazing ways. And we've also got to hear from women in our congregation and in our city that have made an impact and that are just kind of hear through their lens what God is saying. And so it's just been a really cool series for me, and I hope for all of us. And we're going to jump in today. It's my pleasure to talk about Esther. And we got a little the Scripture reading there, but it's an amazing story, and we're only going to be able to cover kind of the surface of it because there's so many details and nuances to it. And so I hope, at the very least, it whets your appetite to dig into the book more because it says a lot to us. So as we begin in the book of Esther, I want to start with asking us to think about how we experience God. For most of us, you know, we don't see the burning bush. We've never seen God lead us through with a pillar of fire. I know for me, most often, I see God when I look back, and then I see him in the past, and I look back on where I've been. And it's sort of this paradox of faith, right? That we see God in the moment once the moment has passed. And this is what I love about Esther, is that her story so resembles ours in that way. That this is a story for those of us that want to follow God, but just struggle to see him sometimes. See, there's no burning bush in this story. There's no pillar of fire. In fact, in the whole book, God's name isn't mentioned a single time. It's not there. It's one of only two books in the Bible where he's not even mentioned. And that's because more often than not, the workings of God are demonstrated in these slow, often imperceptible ways in both our circumstance and the way that he changes our circumstance and the human heart over time. See, God's plan isn't written across the sky. I've never been greeted by angels telling me some secret mystery. But I've grown to recognize God's fingerprints. Though God's name isn't ever written on the pages of Esther, we can see his handiwork all over the place. And this book invites us to read the narrative the same way that we have to examine our own lives, to look for the invisible hand of God working in human affairs. So today, City Light, I want us to walk away with one truth, that we can be confident that God is actively working even when we can't see him, even when he's unseen. We're going to look at three ways that it can be hard to trust that God is working. But we'll see that God is working even when we're put in a place that we would never choose. We're going to see God is working even when he's silent. And last, we're going to see God is working even in the midst of evil. So one, God is working even when we're put in places we would never choose. In chapter one, we're immediately dropped into the scene of the world's great power broker of that day, the Persians. And up until this point in history, there was no other empire that had ever rivaled their level of wealth and power. This kingdom spread from northeastern Africa all the way to the western edge of modern-day India. This was the political and economic center of the known universe. And this is where God's people had been forced to live for the last two centuries. Israel's leaders had been given over to worshiping false gods, and it led to their destruction. So for four generations, the Jews carried the weight of that sin. And just to provide a little bit of context here, in chapter 1, we learn that the ruler of the Persians, King Xerxes, had just ousted his queen, right? That he was kind of this drunken mess, and he had ordered his queen to come and parade herself in front of the people, and she just flat out refused. And so for that, she was dethroned. And let's just say it's pretty clear that we're not in a woman's world, right? This is a hard place to be a woman. But with Xerxes now queenless, the search was on. And the king's servants, he rounded up the most beautiful young women in the kingdom and brought them in to this for this competition to find the next queen. Think of it like The Bachelor Persian edition, you know? It's basically that. So in chapter 2, we're formally introduced to our main characters, Esther and Mordecai. These are both Jews living in the city of Susa, and they're cousins. Esther is actually Mordecai's younger cousin. But it's not this a typical cousin relationship, because Esther as a young girl was orphaned. And so Mordecai was the one that took her in, that welcomed her into his home and became like a father to her. But beyond just learning about their family relationships, one thing becomes unmistakably clear. Esther is a 10 out of 10, right? She's beautiful. She's a stunner. There's no way around that. And so I'm not going to try and interject anything about her inner beauty or anything like that. Like, that's not the point here. The point is that she was the girl that every guy wanted, right? That's what we find out about her. As alluded to before, though, the king, Xerxes, was in this search for a new queen. And that's in full swing, and Esther is absolutely making that cut. And right here, the author slips in this little detail. He says, before leaving the palace, Mordecai made Esther swear to not reveal that she was a Jew. She couldn't say it. So with that in mind, she gets taken into the king's custody. And very quickly, Esther rises to the top. She becomes the most favored woman in the harem. And the guy that was in charge of all these women, Haggai, he takes this huge liking to her. It says in Esther 2, verse 9, "And the young woman pleased him and won his favor, and he quickly advanced her to the best place in the harem." Haggai was on Team Esther, and he's a good ally to have in her corner. So the next phase in this royal selection process is the entire harem goes through this beautification ceremony. Now, I've been in a couple weddings in my life, and there's always one thing that makes me laugh. You know, you get there, the dudes show up like 3 hours before the service starts, and they show up in shorts and a t-shirt, and in like 5 minutes, they're dressed and suited up. And then they spend the next 2 hours and 55 minutes just trying not to get like mustard and Dorito dust on their tie from the Jimmy John's sandwiches. And then they just sit around. Meanwhile, the ladies have been there for like 8 hours, put in a full work day on hair, makeup, and dresses before a single dude has even rolled out of bed. And then 3 minutes into the service, tears come streaming down their faces, eyeliner's everywhere, and it's a complete loss. It's a total loss. All for naught. But ladies, even you have to bow to what these women and Esther had to go through, right? They spent 12 months marinating in oil and myrrh and spices to get ready for the king. So women, consider yourselves lucky. We maybe have progressed just a little. But anyway, Esther and the harem went through this whole process, and the king's selection finally begins. And to simplify, let's just say, things went well for Esther. In chapter 2, verse 17, it says, "And the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favors in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen." I mean, Esther had arrived, right? She'd outshined every other woman in the kingdom. It was smooth sailing now, right? Maybe. But let me just pause for a moment and interject one thought here. I know that for most of us, and probably especially the ladies here, Esther's rise to prominence might seem like a Cinderella story. I mean, what possible hardship could there be for the most beautiful woman in the kingdom that gets whisked away from humble means to live a life of royalty? But the reality is she wasn't being rescued by Prince Charming. Becoming queen was completely out of her control. It wasn't her choice. She was forced to leave her community, her family, and to be brought in a lot of ways against her will. Yes, she'd gained position, but she wasn't powerful. She'd been obligated to marry a man who lived for the thrill of the moment and had unrestrained appetites. And when she wasn't needed by him, she was invisible. She was just one of many wives in his harem. Her palace seemed more like a prison. Maybe this resonates with some of us. Have we ever felt trapped in a life that we didn't choose? Like this bad dream that keeps repeating? Do we feel like God messed up and he put us in the wrong place? Maybe it's the illness that you're suffering with that continues to rack your body. Or maybe you're stuck in a job that you can't leave. Maybe you keep serving in a church and it keeps hurting you. You're not alone here. This isn't a foreign experience, right? It's when we're in the place that feels like a prison that it's hardest to imagine and believe that God is at work behind the scenes. We can't see the guiding hand of God orchestrating his plan, but maybe that boss that constantly is writing you for no good reason will come to you in his moment of brokenness because you continue to show kindness. Maybe that relationship you always wanted that never came is the path that allows you to experience the love of God in 1,000 ways. This is the deeper truth for God's people. There is no brokenness that goes beyond his goodness. See, even when God takes you to a place you would never choose, he is positioning you for his purpose. Whatever your prison was or is, could we take the risk of faith that God is working even when we're put in places we would never choose? I'm going to warn you as we move into step two, into point two, this is an even harder pill to swallow, in that God is working even when he's silent. So as we get into chapter three here, a new character enters the picture, Haman. And if ever there was an archetypal villain in the Bible, it's this man, right? Like, for no reason, he climbs to the second most powerful position in the kingdom. And King Xerxes actually makes this law, this rule that basically says, when Haman walks by, you got to bow to him. And this is kind of the point in the story where we start to smell fire in the forest. See, while all the other servants bowed to Haman, no problem, Mordecai refused. And the servants pressed him and questioned him, like, why are you defying Haman this way? And he didn't budge. But Haman, being the kind of man that he was not about to tolerate insubordination, right? He was a first-class narcissist. And even more than that, he was legitimately a megalomaniac. And we see this by his absurdly disproportionate response in chapter 3. Let's look at chapter 3, verse 5 and 6. It says, "And when Haman saw Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom." And the rest of chapter 3 explains how Haman convinced the king to enact this murderous plan against the Jews. With almost no hesitation, the king mindlessly signs off and sends out this edict throughout the whole kingdom. In verse 13 of chapter 3, it says, "Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instruction to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, in the 13th day of the 12th month." Are you serious, Haman? One dude doesn't bow to you like the grand poobah, and all of a sudden, you're ready to exterminate an entire people. That's just not over the top. That's evil, right? This wasn't even an army that was out and routing their enemies. This was the ruling class engaging in premeditated genocidal ethnic cleansing, right? Like, this is huge. But I want us to step away from the story for just a minute, because I think it's easy for us to look at this and be like, think of it like a fable or a moral anecdote, where sometimes the evil almost seems ridiculous, like ludicrous. But I want us to acknowledge the reality of how twisted the world that we live in today is. Haman isn't an anomaly. Mass violence and hate aren't ancient relics of the past. I mean, the easy comparison is Hitler, right? When we think about a man that started, incited a whole war based on the idea of slaughtering and eliminating the Jews. And he succeeded in killing almost half the Jews in Europe. But he's not even alone. You think about adding guys like Stalin, Mao, Potts, Hussein, and you can add another 100 million deaths to that list, and it goes on from there. But what about today? I mean, we're just talking about the recent past there, but today, there are still millions of people around the globe that are constantly threatened by their government or have had to flee their homes altogether. Think about the Karen and the Kareni friends that sit in this church every week. Do we know why they left Myanmar? They're actually part of what's known as the world's longest-running civil war. Karen civilians were actually forced into slavery. Some of them were legitimately used as human minesweepers. These are the people that sit in our church that can share these stories with us. See, the evil in our world is so real. But it doesn't even have to look like mass genocide. I was talking with a friend this last summer that I'd met, and he works for the women's hotline. And I was kind of asking him some questions about that and asked, you know, how many coworkers do you have? And he says, well, I think there's 50 full-time workers there and about 200 volunteers. And I was a little surprised by that number, but I assumed that they must be part of a regional call center. No, he said, we're just dealing with the metro area. Wait, what? You're saying there's so much violence against women in this city that it takes 50 full-time workers and 200 volunteers to handle the call volume? That's in Omaha today. And the list goes on. I mean, we have the sex trafficking pipeline of the nation goes right down the middle of our town. What about racism and racial disparity? In 2014, the Huffington Post ran this article entitled, Omaha, Nebraska, the most dangerous place in America to be black. So why is God silent? If you're like me, I have to ask the question, where's God in the middle of this? How can this be? How can a good God sit back and do nothing? And yet it's in these extended periods of silence when all seems lost that God, that we're asked to trust that God is continuing to work even when he's silent. To the world, this is madness. But for those of us who have seen the legacy of God's perfect faithfulness to his people, it's the only reasonable response. Faith to believe that silence is not absence. Friends, God is working even when he's silent. But now we've got to move into the most critical moment in the story. See, God is actively working in the midst of evil. Back in our story, the king's edict of destruction has gone out across the kingdom. And I think the response that we see from Mordecai and the people of Israel is so instructive. It's three simple steps. Mourn, pray, act. In chapter 4, verse 1, we read, when Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes and he put on sackcloth and ashes and he went out into the midst of the city and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. Mordecai is completely broken for his people. The first thing we see him do is weep over this injustice. He allows the depth of his grief to come pouring out. And I think we have to ask ourselves, do we actually mourn the injustice around us? When was the last time that we wept for the brokenness of our world? So often I think we're too insulated from the destitute to ever see their pain, or we're just too afraid to feel it. It's easier to live without knowing, right? But we see Mordecai enters into the weight of this injustice. In chapter 4, verse 3, it goes on and it says, and in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting. See, here we see the Jews do the exact same thing as Mordecai did. Their first response is mourning. And then they do what faithful people of God have always done when there's evil too great to fix. They pray. Right? They recognize that there's no hope outside of divine intervention. But don't you and I know I do, I tend to skip the first two steps, right? I so often just want to fix the problems. I want to start strategizing, planning, coordinating, coalition building. I mean, this is how things get done, right? This is the real world. But the order of operations matters. If we don't mourn the injustice around us before we start making an attempt to fix it, then aren't we just trying to be the hero of the story? To make it about us, that I think our mourning actually lays the foundation of love towards the broken. And if we don't seek the Lord in prayer before we start working against injustice, then who are we working for? Fasting and prayer position our hearts to see unless God works for us, we're wasting our time. And it forces us to take God at his word, that he hates injustice more than we do, and that he loves to act for his people. But once we've mourned and once we've prayed, then it's time to get to work. Because working against injustice without seeking God is just ineffective. But seeking God's power to fight injustice and then failing to act when he gives it, that's just cowardice. So let's watch as Mordecai goes to work. He has to go speak to Esther. See, Esther is so isolated inside her palace that she's unaware of this edict that's gone out, of the potential slaughter of the Jews. So Mordecai passes this message to Esther and relays Haman's plans and pleads with her, go and beg to King Xerxes for the Jews. And we see Esther's anguish in her response. She says in chapter 4, verse 11, and all the king's servants and the people in the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside of the inner court without being called, there is but one law, to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king. She had to be thinking, does Mordecai even know what he's asking me? I can't just waltz up to the king. See, Esther is pleading her case to Mordecai. She's trying to make this abundantly clear that just because I'm queen doesn't mean the rules are any different for me. My life is at stake here. First, Mordecai, you forbid me from talking about the Jews, and then I'm asked to risk my life for them. But Mordecai, he doesn't back off at all. We see that he presses the point further. In verse 13, he says, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than the other Jews. Mordecai is saying, you can't get away from this problem by ignoring it. This evil won't spare anybody. So, Esther, you can either choose to actively work against it, or you can quietly be destroyed by it. See, this is the moment of truth for Esther. She's in this impossible situation where there's no easy escape. If she goes to the king unsolicited, he could kill her for breaking the law. If she does nothing, she's probably going to get discovered as a Jew anyway and be killed that way. So it's truly this damned if you do, damned if you don't moment. But listen for this like subtle but profound implication in Mordecai's appeal. In verse 14 of chapter 4, he says, for if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to this kingdom for such a time as this. He's saying to Esther, if you fail to act, God will raise somebody up. You're not the only option. There is others that he will bring, but Esther, I really think you're God's first choice. I think you're the one that he wants to use to save his people. See, Mordecai is banking on the sovereignty of God, and he's asking Esther to do the same, to put trust that God had planted her there in advance for this exact moment in time. And look at Esther's response here in verses 14 and 15 and 16. It's so good. She says, go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. I love her ultimatum here because she's saying, only after you go and seek God with me, then will I go. Right? She's asking her people to put skin in the game, to join her, that even though she's the one that's risking her life, that they've got to all seek the Lord together. Because ultimately Esther realizes and believes that there's only one real king to please. See, Esther steps into this call to advocate for her people. She begins to believe that maybe, in the middle of all this, that she was the person that God has placed there to change the fate of her people. And even though it's not a guarantee, it's this holy risk. Friends, you know how I know that God is working in the midst of evil? How I know that he's working in our city, despite all the evil that we see around, all the brokenness that we see. When the world is screaming, God is dead, that God is actually working behind the scenes. I'm confident because you are here. Because today, like Esther and like all of redemptive history, God has planted his people right in the middle of the darkest moments. Not to punish us, not for us to needlessly suffer. This is because God has always used his people as the agents of God's change. See, when the night is darkest and we feel the weight of injustice pressing in with this overwhelming force, we can stand in confidence that God has placed you where you are in the middle of that to turn the tide. And God continues in the story to give Esther favor. We see she goes on to win the heart of the king, and she pleads for the people. And in this like amazing, ironic twist, Mordecai gets hung on the very gallows that he built for, Haman gets hanged on the very gallows he built for Mordecai. And in time, we see Israel was able to defend themselves against their attackers and reestablish peace. Right? We see God's plan come together there at the end. So this morning, you know, we've looked at kind of three ways that God works. That God works even when we're put in places that we would never choose. God works even when he's silent. And he's working even in the midst of evil. Church, we can be confident that God is working even when he's unseen. Do you think that maybe God wants to use his people, us, to turn the tides in our city? To see the marginalized given a voice, to see righteous laws in action and leaders standing up for those at the bottom. I'm confident he is, and I'm confident that he's already been doing that. Because I've seen what God has started to do in this church. To see so many of you start to reorient your lives to serve the broken. To share meals with them, to invite them into your home, and to welcome them into your lives. It's happening right now. And this call to surrender our own ambition for the sake of a greater kingdom isn't just given to a few, right? It's not for the select group of extraordinary people. It's not just for the Esthers. It's the central purpose and call for the people of God. See, we have a Savior that's greater than Esther. One who crushed our enemy under his foot. And he's fighting the battles for us, but we're called to join him and be those that are living to bring deliverance and hope to those that need it. Don't those words of Esther, if I perish, I perish, don't those sound strikingly similar to our advocate? He said, Father, not my will, but your will be done. I think Esther is such a timely story for our church. See, we are also strangers in a foreign land, right? We're aliens in a world that's not our home. And we've been joined to a royal family. And we're called to a world that seeks to silence the people of God. And over these next months and years, we're going to be stepping into uncharted waters where we don't know the outcome. But I think that as we step out of our safety, our own little kingdoms, we're going to discover that King Jesus is the one that's inviting those people, the marginalized in the world, to his feast, to be a part of his kingdom, and we get to join him in that. You know, as part of this Remarkable Women series, we've had the blessing of hearing from some amazing women in our church and in our city. And I get the privilege of welcoming up my good friend, Chase Vanderveen. And many of you might know Chase and Rob and have heard some of their story. But I want to invite us to listen as Chase shares through her lens just some of the ways that God has called her and I think called all of us to step out in faith. And I think you're going to be blessed by it. So thanks, Chase.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much, Zach, for sharing that beautiful message on Esther. I think the thing that impacted me the most from the story of Esther is that God used an very unlikely person, a minority woman, to save an entire race. We get to see Esther take a huge leap of faith and use her privilege as queen to advocate for the least. For 2 years, Robbie and I prayed hard and every single day, and we had the commitment of friends and pastors and loved ones praying with us and alongside us for a decision that we needed to make, and we knew it was in 2018. So a year ago to the day, December 16th, 2017, Robbie and I made our first phone call to the landlord at the apartments over on 51st and Northwest Radial Highway about potentially living there. I was 25 years old and ready to buy my first home like so many of my friends my age. But we just felt like God was calling us in a different direction and out of our comfort zones, urging us to move into the apartment complex that we used to teach ESL in once a week. We felt like we could do the most good by moving in directly into their apartment complex and living life right alongside them. I will be brutally honest, I was terrified of living life alongside people who didn't speak my language, and honestly living with mice and bed bugs and cockroaches and unsolved maintenance issues that would go on for months, and then spending like $800 a month to do it. For us, we knew what God was calling us to, and we knew that it wasn't moving into a house just down the street, but it was to move in right next to them. We knew the call, it was just a question of whether or not we would obey. So we moved in January 2018, and over the last 12 months, Robbie and my lives have changed drastically, to say the least. We knew that if we were going to live there, we would have to sacrifice time, and a lot of it, and we would have to sacrifice personal space and comfort. So about 3 weeks into living there, we found bed bugs on our walls and in our bed, and I will be honest about my response to it. I panicked, like, utter panic. I had to keep myself from hyperventilating, and I wish that I was exaggerating, but I'm not. With Robbie next to me as we looked down at the bugs, like, I just aggressively told God out loud, like, God, like, I moved into this apartment for you. Like, I can handle the fact that our toilet isn't bolted into the ground, and every time you sit on it, it rocks forward. Like, I can handle that we don't have hot water most days, but, like, I cannot do bed bugs. That is not what I signed up for. And in my selfishness and sin, like, I thought I was somehow innately too clean, too privileged, too good to deal with something like bed bugs. Like, it honestly makes me cringe telling you all this. But I had already resolved to spend the next week at Brett and Jeff's house until we could just, like, get it sorted out. But Robbie reminded me, do you think our neighbors have a nice home to run to when things just get bad at the apartments? When our neighbors have bed bugs, they have no choice but to sleep at their apartment that night. And so we don't either. And he was absolutely right. If we were going to live here, we needed to put aside our privilege. I remembered that Jesus gave up heaven to live on this earth with us messy fallen people. Us living with bed bugs was nothing. I would learn quickly that these people were eager for an advocate. Every single day, there was a need for something and for help, and our names traveled quickly among the neighbors. Thramu, they called me, before they even knew my name, the teacher. The moms that I helped would bring new people to me the next day, and then those new people would bring their friends too. The DMV, the doctor's offices, the apartment office, the schools all knew my face and name quickly, and I was given many opportunities to advocate for them in those spaces. When they haven't known what to do, they've come to our door, and we have been so humbled. Humbled by Jesus for allowing us to be used, humbled to advocate for the Karen people, our family. I'd like to share one of about 100 stories of God making a way for us to advocate for them and give them a voice. So one family needed to renew their lease back in July, and they have 12 people live in their apartment. So like only two of them in the family work because the rest of them are in school, so it is very difficult to make ends meet. So I drove my neighbor down to the apartment office to re-sign her lease, and when we got there, they told us that the rent was going to be increased like $35 a month, and they already pay $800, so $35 a month is like not a small increase. And so I pleaded with I could just see the concern on my neighbor's face, and I pleaded with the woman working there, like, please, like, who can I talk to switch this? And she kind of just rolled her eyes and didn't say anything and left, and a man returned with her, and he says, like, I hear you're trying to keep her rent the same. Everyone's rent increases annually. Why do you think she should be the exception? And I said, sir, I live there too. Like, I'm speaking from my own experience. These apartments are not good. Like, they're not even worth the $800 they're already paying. And I was so red in the face. I was super embarrassed and, like, couldn't believe I said it. And he looked a little shocked that I said it too. But he kind of paused and was just like, yeah, I really appreciate your honesty. Like, we'll keep the rent the same. And needless to say, Mupa and I did like a little happy dance in the car the entire way home. And God had just rewarded my advocacy, and he allowed me to be a voice for them. And it just started to become more and more clear that God had put us there for such a time as this. And a few weeks after that, I was putting away some groceries in my kitchen when my unlocked door swung wide open in a hurry. And it was Mupa again, breathless, asking me to come help right away. I dropped what I was holding, and I ran out after her, and I had no idea what had happened, but I went out to the back parking lot, and there was a group of Karen people that had gathered around this like tall white guy with all black clothes and a gun on his hip, and it was an eviction officer from our apartment saying that he had this letter from the landlord saying that this family should have been moved out weeks ago. And I was like, why? Like, you need to tell me why. And he looked at me, he's like, well, who are you? And I was like, oh, like, I'm just a friend of the family, and they've asked me to help them because, you know, they can't defend themselves in English. And he said all he knew was that the landlord had said that they never signed another lease, and so he suspected that they should be moved out, and if not, he would make them. And my heart for justice, like, pounded out of my chest. I was like, that can't be true, because I was the one who went with them 3 weeks ago to the apartments to sign a new lease, so you can't evict them. And he said, ma'am, I'm just giving you the information I have. So I refused to accept that. We continued until we confirmed that the family had indeed signed a new lease, but that was after he didn't believe me that I lived there. After all, in his words, why would someone like you live here? I think humans have a hard time believing that God would call us to lay down our lives for others. And I get emotional thinking about the possibility of this family getting kicked out of their apartment on false claims had someone not been there to defend them. My study Bible tells me that neither Esther nor Mordecai would have had any choice in the matter regarding her getting taken to be one of the beautiful virgins available to the king. So let's be clear. This wasn't Esther's plan, and she didn't go into this thinking she would just save all the Jews from complete destruction. She had no idea her purpose in being queen. And, you know, Robbie and I, too, didn't know what God planned for us at the apartments. We didn't know this year would be such a radical year of extending our family, breaking down racial and cultural barriers, and starting something so beautiful that it would start to permeate into our American friendships, too. Even though Esther gained esteem, like Zach said, she had to lose so much too, including her true identity as a Jew, an exiled one, a minority. Esther was willing to risk everything to save the Jews. She is a picture of hope, the advocate God put in place to go to the king on the people's behalf and save his people. I hope you can understand Jesus' role more clearly. He is our capital A advocate, the one who goes to the Father on our behalf to defend us. God's righteous law pronounces us guilty on all counts. We have violated God's standards, rejected his right to rule our lives, and continued to sin even after coming to a knowledge of the truth. The only just punishment for our wickedness is an eternity in hell. But Jesus stands as the advocate between our repentant hearts and the law. If his blood has been applied to our lives, he pleads our case with the righteous judge, and we are freed. As for me, I don't know why, but I was born white in a country that affords more opportunities to people with my skin color, and I have never wondered where my next meal would come from. I was born privileged. I had no choice in the matter, but the choice I was and am given every day is regarding how I will use that privilege. How will I elevate others who deserve to be elevated? How will I give voice to the voiceless? How will I stand up for the weak? Remember, we aren't working for an earthly ruler, but rather our God, who rules an upside-down kingdom where the low will be brought high and the high will be brought low. I am not Esther, and I am certainly not Jesus, but I do believe God has called me into a role where I am to advocate for the least of these, the ones without a voice. There is nothing special about Robbie and me, truly. God used us because we put ourselves into a position to be used. So I have to ask the question, where do you see God calling you for such a time as this? Who has God called you to? Would you examine your life, your privilege, take up the cause of something and run hard after it with gospel motivation? Has he called you to refugees, the homeless, victims of sex trafficking, prisoners, people with mental illness, single moms, people with disabilities, foster children, crime-ridden neighborhoods, or somewhere else? You may look at Robbie and my story and think you couldn't do it, but our story is not and should not be the exception. He has called every one of you. You have the risen Son living inside of you. If you don't believe God has a creative and radical plan for your life, then you are wrong. Like, rethink that and re-examine that. Esther was willing to die if that's what it took. Jesus wasn't just willing to die, he did die. So you have victory over fear, hesitation, doubt, and discomfort. Paul says in Ephesians, as a prisoner for the Lord then, I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received.